is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Nobody was really afraid of the moment. We coached the first game of the season, whether we're up by 30, really the same that we would a national championship game, so that when you get in those moments, nothing feels different.
Josh Merkel is the head men's basketball coach at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. He just completed his seventh season by winning the Division III national championship in 2022. Merkel was named NABC Division III Coach of the Year, the ODAC Coach of the Year for the fifth consecutive season, and was named the recipient of the Glenn Robinson Award for the second straight year, which is presented annually to the top Division III head coach. The Yellow Jackets have an overall record of 148-38 since Merkel took over in 2015. His career record as a head coach stands at 209-79. Merkel previously served as head coach at his alma mater Salisbury from 2011 to 2015. The Seagulls were 66-41 over those 4 years. Merkel was an assistant coach for 5 seasons at D1 Eastern Kentucky, for 1 season at Randolph-Macon, and served as a graduate assistant coach at West Virginia under head coach John Beilein. Josh was a 4-year letter winner in men's basketball at Salisbury, where he averaged 9.3 points per game, 2.5 rebounds, and 1.8 assists in 98 games, and served as a captain during his senior season. Hey Hoopheads, transform your training this April with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get $1,500 off any new machine in the month of April. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdish.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is former NBA player CJ Watson, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram. And be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Josh Merkel, men's basketball head coach at Randolph-Macon College, the 2022 Division III national champions. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Plinzing here without my co-host Jason Sokol tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Josh Merkel, the head men's basketball coach at Randolph-Macon College, Division III national champions here
in the year 2022. Josh, first of all, congratulations and welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Yeah, excited to be on and talk some hoops with you, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Probably has a good ring to put that national championship at the end of your introduction, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we'll take it. I'm not giving it back at this point.
Understood. All right, let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me about your first experience with the game of basketball, how you got into the game.
Yeah, love bragging about my mom and my family. So my mom played at University of Maryland, then coached there for 3 years. Then had me, then had 8 more kids. So I'm the oldest of 9. Wow. And but it was a huge passion for her. She was a big time athlete. I actually tried out for the Olympic team during that run. And so still plays in women's leagues all the way into her mid-60s. So I would say that passion. She was my first coach. She taught me how to shoot. Dad, not as athletic, but the work ethic. And he built a court for us. And I could just be seen shooting on that thing all hours of the day. And that was my first experience. We grew up on a farm, so not a lot of competition, but the shooting piece, you know, me being in the backyard, that happened quite a bit.
Always basketball, or were there other sports too?
We're a big basketball soccer family. I believe 7 of the 9 in our family ended up playing some type of college sport, maybe 6 of 9. But it was either basketball, soccer. There was some tennis in there. But yeah, those are the main two. And that was it. Yeah, those two did a lot of that.
As you got into high school, what do you remember about your experiences as a high school player? Maybe a favorite memory that stands out for you?
So I got lucky. My high school, instead of going to the local public school, I went to Prospect Hall, St. John's Prospect Hall. Went there for 4 years. My JV coach, Kevin Sutton, who has since gone on to coach a bunch of different places, college, high major level. Just a phenomenal psychology major and a phenomenal mentor for me. And he's actually the reason that I still remember my 9th grade year saying, that's who I want to be. I want to be that inspiration to other young people, other high school guys. I always thought I want to be a high school coach. Got to work for the legendary Stu Vetter, who should be in the High School Hall of Fame at some point, kind of a Dean Smith disciple. So we learned commitment, 11-month-a-year program. You might get that month of August off, but we lifted. We did the preseason, postseason. It was really a 5 to 6 day a week thing. Study halls, then practice, getting home late. So, Mike, I got extremely lucky that, you know, we were 7th in the country my junior year and 2nd in the country my senior year. To be exposed to that level of commitment is really what built my foundation.
Coach Sutton's tremendous. He's been on with us and got connected to him through Alan Stein. And he was just a tremendous, tremendous interview. Great guy. You can just tell the passion that he has for the game of basketball. So I'm sure being exposed to him at a young age, man, there, you don't get many better role models than that for sure.
Well, I got to tell you, and I got him, you know, young part of his career, but every lunch period, it was, you hear the bell ring, I hurry up, I run downstairs, locker room, change, get a 30-minute or so workout with him. He's rebounding, shooting, putting me through all these drills that he's testing out, trash cans everywhere. And then it was a race, you know, maybe 4 minutes before the bell rings, go back down, no shower, throw my clothes back on. I'm eating my sandwich before I get to the next class. And that was really a 4-year deal where I made he had me brainwashed that we had to do this thing every lunchtime to get better.
And that was a little different in terms of – at that time, there wasn't as much of that training like we see today with kids. A lot of us were more on our own and working out, and you had that opportunity to work with him. It's sort of unusual for the time when you were growing up.
Yes. I mean, and that's why I say I was so, you know, blessed and fortunate. But yeah, there was definitely none of the, like, the individual training. And it was open to anybody that wanted to make it. And we had a lot of guys in there, but I would say probably no one had maybe – I was one of the few. I needed to be in there, you know. I mean, we had some talented guys that I was around. And I've been an underdog ever since then. And I still need to be, you know, working on my craft if I want to, you know, be as good as some of these other guys.
When did college basketball get on your radar in terms of being a player? What was your recruitment like?
Like every shoot. I mean, it's probably on my radar before I was ever ready. Being at that high level of a program and, you know, 8 Division I guys on that team alone, you feel like, you know, you got coaches in the gym all the time. So my recruitment was Division III mostly, a little bit of Division II recruitment. And I ended up where I was supposed to be. You know, I was a 2-guard, 6'1". I wasn't the point guard, didn't have the speed, could shoot it, play hard, you know, learned how to compete and learned just a love for the game. So I ended up going to Salisbury University in Maryland, which really, you know, cost was a big factor. They had just gone to the Elite Eight the year before. That was another factor. And, you know, wanted to win, came from that high level winning program. So ended up playing for Ward Lambert there for my first 3 years and then Steve Holmes my last year.
What was the adjustment like for you going from your high school situation to the college situation, both in terms of same things that your players deal with today, right? Academically, socially, basketball wise, what do you remember about that transition?
Yeah, I remember this, Mike, that you're almost made to feel like a failure when you don't get a scholarship. I will say that, like, even then, that was 20 years ago, 1997, when I graduated. So I felt that. I felt like, all right, well, you know, I had a chip on my shoulder and I wanted to prove that that I could really play. So I was probably a little more serious and intentional, you know, even then. I mean, obviously I'm a coach now, but I was maybe a little more basketball focused than some of my teammates. Wish we had a little bit more committed group overall, had some, but not all. And I remember that transition being tough, going from, you know, the structure and discipline that I had come from to, you know, in Division III, where you can't work as well, you know, or you just can't work with your coaches on the off season. We did have a strict conditioning program on the track. Coach Lambert was like a Loyola Marymount guy, and kind of studied under those guys. So we were always top 10 in scoring in the country. And really you had to get through a pretty rigorous track workout in the preseason, which really weeded a bunch of guys out.
Yeah, that'll do it quick, right? Get out on track without a basketball. That'll drive guys away pretty fast if you want to drive them away.
And at 6 a.m. was the other clincher. And so every practice was 6 a.m. for my first 3 years of college. That weeded a bunch of other good players out.
So you talked a little bit there about the fact that when you're coming out of high school, obviously, and a bunch of your teammates are going and playing Division I, getting basketball scholarships, and you end up going the Division III route. So you have that experience. So when you think about yourself now as a Division III head coach, obviously, if you're going to win at the level that you guys have been able to win at in Division III, you have to be going out after those players who may have some opportunities to be scholarship players, whether at the Division II or, you know, kids that fall through the cracks that maybe if they were in the right situation to play Division I. So how do you use your experience back 20 years ago to have conversations with recruits, or just the way maybe you approach that recruiting process with players who are, again, probably capable of playing at a level above where, you know, where you guys are?
Yeah. I mean, Mike, even that question is a great one. Shows that you've been doing this a long time too, and you get it. It has helped my approach, helped me be more patient with guys because, you know, I wanted to play at the highest level too. And I even pushed some D3s away, probably where I shouldn't have. Things were a little bit different back then. And again, I'm the oldest of nine, so it's not like I could hop in the car and have mom and dad drive me around everywhere. In fact, the two Division III visits I took three, actually. And the school that probably did the best job, Catholic University, I just couldn't afford at the end of the day either. You know, that whole financial aid and thing. So, but I drove myself to Salisbury and Washington, and my parents weren't involved in those particular visits. So it helps with my approach. And then I've got those high school pictures up. I kind of, you know, basically say I've been where you've been. Here's the thing that's important, though. At some point, you know, I'll say, hey, you can dream big. You know, I want you to get that offer. If you don't, you can change your dream. You know, you can dream to be cut down a net, win a national championship, be an impact player, you know, have a seat on the bus that you can really be proud of, have a career that you can be proud of. I just think, you know, your career is not over when you don't get that offer. And when we get the right guys that understand that, have the maturity to be able to understand that, you know, I ask guys in recruiting, are you a D1 or bust guy? Meaning, if you don't get an offer, is that just going to crush you and you're just going to give up basketball? And some guys, yes. Or some guys are going to go the prep route. Some guys are going to go the walk-on route. Because they feel like that's the next best thing, which I think is pretty far from it. I think, you know, next best thing is go be a great player at a small college and maybe prove to some people, maybe we missed on that guy. Maybe we missed on that guy. Going to walk-on doesn't necessarily generate the same, I guess, level of what people would say. But
yeah, it's interesting. I think I forget just recently I was talking to somebody and they said that you know, there's so much pressure on high school kids, especially with social media today, that you think about, you know, how many times do you go and scroll through social media, committed here and scholarship there? And kids, when you and I were growing up, that didn't exist. And so you didn't see, maybe you knew where some of your local guys were going, but you certainly didn't know where people were going all over the country the way kids do today. And this person said to me basically that, like, when you make a decision to go to college, there's some fanfare in the first week or two. And then after that, everybody just moves on. It doesn't really matter. Like, nobody remembers that you got a Division I scholarship. There's, you know, your family and maybe some of your close friends and people they have, but the greater world doesn't necessarily remember. And I think that it speaks to, right, finding the right fit and finding the right program, finding the right school, finding the right coaching staff. And I think sometimes, as you said, we get caught up in that, hey, it's Division I or bust. And so many people, I think, are unaware of how good Division III basketball is. And I think that's one of the things that we've really tried to highlight here on the podcast, Josh, is just in our conversations with Division III coaches, is trying to get people to understand that, look, the level of basketball that's being played at Division III, so many people are unaware of it because they've never been to a game. Or we talked to John Baines from Elmhurst, and John told us, he's like, I talked to so many recruits that they come in and they're like, they've never even seen a Division III game. And they're already like, Division III, whatever. And so it's just, I think, making people aware of just how good the level of play is and how good of a player you have to be in order to play at the Division III level. I think people have no understanding of that.
Yeah. Well, two things I'll say to that too, Mike, and I did my homework, man. I saw that you were a big time player, 1,000-point scorer yourself at that level. And it's very cool that you would shine the light on some of the smaller college guys, because some guys that play at that level, you know, just haven't been exposed to it. And if you don't know, you don't know. I think D3 gets a bad rap for a couple of reasons. Number one, D1s do not play great D3s. They just don't. You know, there's nothing to win. And I get that. No problem. But then they play really bad D3s, and it makes people think like this is all D3s. And so it's fine if you won't play us, but I wish society as a whole would understand. We talk about there's six levels. There's, you know, high major and high level D1, and then there's low major. And, you know, you take that D2 high and low, D3 high and low, and that high major D3 can compete with a certain low major D1. And even high major D2s in our case. I mean, we played a top five Division II team and we're neck and neck in one possession game at their place. You know, none of those guys are coming to us. Even Richmond, you know, 3 years ago, 6-point game with 6 minutes to go. And obviously we haven't gotten the game since.
That was your last chance, right?
That, you know, for a little while. I appreciate that. You know, you would shine the light and maybe help some other people get some exposure and just realize. And we've been, so our point guard, National Player of the Year, stud, and just a really good player. And we went through this agent process. He signed with an agent. He's going to be playing overseas. The agent said something interesting, and I think it applies. He said, you know, there's 100 guys in Europe that should be playing in the NBA. There's 100 guys in the NBA that should be playing in Europe. And you could easily apply that to Division III and Division I. 100 guys in Division III should be playing Division I. You know, we certainly have one of them. And if not a couple more, as those guys mature and get into their game, and vice versa. I mean, shoot, there's a bunch of Division I guys that could not impact and help us win.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I think you said it when you were talking about yourself, that you had this dream of playing at the highest level. And I think as a kid, it's difficult to balance that, right? I think back to my own situation, and I ended up going to what turned out to be the right place for me as a Division I college basketball player. But I'm certain that I could have gone to a lot of other schools, and my style of play or the type of player I was wouldn't have meshed with that coach's style or that coach's personality. I just ended up in a place where the things that I could do were appreciated, and it worked out for me. And when I was hearing your story, one of the things that also struck me is just the fact that, you know, you went and made your visits by yourself and trying to figure this whole thing out. And there just wasn't as much information out there about what you should be doing or shouldn't be doing. And I've told this story a couple of times on the podcast, but my recruiting, like when I got recruited to Kent State, where I ultimately ended up going, in the summer before my junior year, or sorry, before my senior year, they called me up and said, "Hey, we want you to come down and take an official visit." And I had no idea. My high school coach had never had anybody that, you know, was at this level. And I told him no. I said, "I'm going to come down and take an unofficial visit," because I still was waiting for Ohio State and North Carolina and Duke. And I thought those things were coming. I didn't know any better. And I had a lot of Division III's that I was talking to at the time, and I continued to talk with them. But I didn't have any idea of what was realistic for me, because I didn't have anybody in my circle that really kind of understood what the process looked like. And so I ended up making a mistake and then had to kind of re-recruit myself back to Kent. And that was my only Division I offer. And I'm sure there were a lot of people out there that thought, "Hey, this kid's going to go there and he's never going to be able to make it. And like I said, there probably were places where that would have been the case. Yeah. And I just happened to, by sheer luck more than anything else, end up in a place where it worked for me. But you see lots of kids who make that decision that don't end up in the right place. They make decisions for the wrong reasons. And I think ultimately, I think we're doing a better job now of at least getting the word out and trying to educate people that it's about more than just, hey, the level and what I can post on social media. It's really about, what's my experience going to be like for 4 years? What kind of school am I going to? What kind of coach am I going to play for? And ultimately, look, the reason why we all started playing is because we want to play. And if you're going to go sit on the bench, or as you said, you know, go the walk-on route, I mean, we all know that's not an easy, that's not an easy route to go. And if you're going to go through the grind of a college basketball season with little to no chance to play, and I did that quite a bit my freshman year, man, that was by far the toughest year of my life to go through and do all the things that are required and then not get out on the floor. That's a challenge. And so I think what we've tried to do, again, like I said, is just make sure that in our conversations with Division III coaches, to try to give them the opportunity to talk about just how good the level of play is and how good you have to be able to play at that level. And I think you did a good job of explaining that with the story that you just told about, hey, there's 100 guys that could be here versus there and that level. And it's really about finding the right fit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a quote from a guy that's a really good player at Randolph Macon years ago. And a reporter said, you know, "Hey, I know you've thought about it, and I know you've probably had some interest or offers to play higher. You know, why haven't you?" And he basically said, "I'm where I'm supposed to be." And so for that young man at that time to be able to deliver that message, something we all can learn from and hear. And, you know, even in my own shoes, I'm like, man, that hits home. Like, I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be at the level and at the school. It's been a good marriage and a good fit. And you just appreciate the guys that are blooming where they're planted, being where their feet are, because that's such a great thing in life to have that, to just, man, I'm where I'm supposed to be. If you can do that in life with your job, with your marriage, it's going to be a good life. And I think everyone else, look at the transfers people are chasing. They're chasing the next hit, so the endorphins and everything. And I think that's what happens a lot of times. Like, guys are, you know, transferring, starters leaving Kentucky for what? It's like, because they're chasing that feeling they got and all the attention that they got, and then you're not getting it, and they don't know where to turn, in my opinion.
I'm with you 100%. I just think that the transfer portal, I get the benefits of it for players, and I'm not sure that the old system where coaches could leave at their own volition and then players were stuck, I'm not sure that that was great either. But yeah, what we've set up now is just everybody in it. It's invaded at lower levels too. It's down in the high schools, and you think about just what AAU looks like and guys jumping from this team to that team. And it's something that I think we're going to have to continue to wrestle with and figure out, how do we get this situation where there's a balance between giving kids an opportunity if they end up in a place that maybe isn't the right fit for them or isn't what they thought, versus like everybody just is jumping at the next opportunity. And as you said, chasing those endorphins and chasing, again, that recognition that maybe they had previously. And it has to be about more than just what's happening on the basketball floor. You really got to consider, again, what it's like socially, what it's like academically for you at a school. And that to me is really, really critical as we start looking at what this is all about.
Mike, it's amazing. Maybe if the listeners get one thing, but, you know, recruiting every day for me. And one thing that I'm still having a hard time with is this, like, you know, for my son, I want him to be surrounded by great people, and who you work for matters, or the leader in that program matters. And the fact that people leave that to chance, the fact that people will turn down, you know, what they know for the hope for a higher level. And who cares what type of, you know, guys are in there? I'm not saying, you know, bad character, but maybe they're a little more selfish, or maybe it's a losing culture. And they just don't even know. Like, guys are saying no to us in hopes that someone will come along and have no relationship with that guy. To me, you know, I'm trying to get through that as much as possible and kind of flesh through, so we're not wasting time on those guys or that mindset and that family, that the level is what matters more than the people. I just don't understand why people don't spend more time even asking me good questions about, all right, what is your philosophy? How do you teach leadership? What is your vision for my son off the court? I mean, people just don't even ask it.
Well, and let's take that off the table and just think about the fact that, look, what do most kids that are playing basketball, they dream about? What? Playing in the NBA? Not realistic for most kids, but hey, being able to play professionally is way more realistic than it's ever been in the past, just because of the explosion of basketball internationally. So here you are with a Division III player that you're just describing. For us, it's going to play professionally overseas. You don't have to be a Division I player to go and be able to make a living and travel and get those experiences that, again, are invaluable when you're a young person, to be able to go and travel and play basketball. And if you take advantage of all the things that can go along with that, I mean, it doesn't have to be, there's more than one path to get to where you want to go. And I think you make a great point that you're amazed. And I can speak to this just talking to parents and sitting in stands and listening to people talk, that they really don't. People get themselves all worked up at all levels. I mean, you can go down to second, third grade and people are going to showcases and trying to get ranked and worried about this and that. And, you know, ultimately, I think what you want to have is a good experience. And you have a good experience, as you said, by being surrounded by the right people. And that right people can include your coaching staff and includes your teammates, includes the kind of culture that you want to build. And if you get in that environment, you're going to have success, however you want to define that. Everybody defines it slightly differently. But to me, getting in the right fit and finding the right place is critical. So if anybody who's out there, and it's been a recurring theme, but, you know, recruits, parents, high school coaches, those are the kinds of questions, what you just described, that people should be asking. You should be asking anybody, any place you're considering going, ask those questions. Like, how are we going to develop you, not only as a basketball player, but as a human being, as a leader? And how much do we care about you as not just a basketball player, but as a person? That to me is critical.
And I would want to sit down and have some lunch with the players in that program. You know, when my sons, if they, you know, good enough to play somewhere, like, hey, let's go have lunch with your team or some members on the team. And then good culture, you can feel it. Like, you really can. You're going to be able to, you know, get a good sense of what the coaching is like and what those guys, how connected they are, how committed they are. And well, and also if you can play with those guys, even better. Play with them really well.
Yeah, that's the missing piece, right? Sometimes you're, again, it goes back to how many Division III games have you seen as a recruit? Do you know how good those kids are? And we're to step out on the floor with them, man, people, again, have no idea how fine that line is and how good you have to be in order to be able to play college basketball. So thinking back, you mentioned earlier that you kind of always had in mind that at some point you wanted to get into coaching. You said, hey, high school coaching, being a high school teacher, being a high school coach, that was kind of where you started. And that's where you started your career. So talk a little bit about that first experience, getting out and getting into coaching. And then as you talk a little bit about your high school experience, we can talk about how the opportunity comes for you to get the GA job at West Virginia and then move into the college ranks. But start out with your high school experience as a coach.
Yeah. So I played 4 years at Salisbury. I graduate from there. And I got connected right away with my Bruce Kelly, who's at Prospect Hall. So my alma mater had a different coach by the time I graduated. And I had gone back and practiced with him. Bruce, former D1 assistant, coached at American, phenomenal guy, still a mentor to me to this day, coaches at Bullis High School in Maryland. And so I got connected with Bruce. I was his varsity assistant and JV head coach there for 3 years. It was awesome, running my own program for a couple of those years. I mean, I was all in. I was helping with the JV workouts, the varsity workouts, My mom was coaching on the women's side for a couple of years. My two sisters were playing on the women's team. I'd help them where I could. It was like a family affair over there. And I loved it. I was doing personal training on the side, or basketball training on the side. And the opportunity. So what happened was Jeff Neubauer came and spoke at camp, and he and Bruce Kelly had a connection. And I was just asking him about offense for my JV team. And Neubauer is a wizard offensively. And we connected through that talk. And he said, you know, we're going to have a GA position a year from now. You should apply, basically. All right. Hey, send me an email, you know, just stay in touch with me. So sure enough, I would watch every West Virginia game. And I, you know, I wasn't crazy with it, but at least once a week, I'd shoot him an email, a question or two. Hey, what's the bottom guy's responsibility on the 1-3-1? I mean, this is for the whole season. And I went up there. I interviewed. I think it helped that I was a little bit older of a GA. I was 25 at the time. I just put 3 years in of high school coaching. I know Beeline. He liked that. He liked that I wasn't in a relationship. I was single, ready to just get to work. I know he liked that. And then we joke, you know, I say, Coach, I know I was like your 10th choice. He's like, no, Josh, you were like my 15th choice. He had some good, you know, former players. And so here I go from Division III player and high school assistant to a Big East GA. We start the year by going to Europe and playing on a tour 10 days over there. And then that particular year was the Pitsnoggle, Gansey, you know, his son Beeline, good player, Ty Sally, goes to the Elite Eight and is a basket away or a stop away from beating Patino and going to the Final Four. That was my first experience in college coaching. Jeff Neubauer was the head coach, associate head coach. Based on our run, he gets the job at Eastern Kentucky, and he takes me with him. So now at 26, I'm a, you know, OVC assistant coach. And for the next 5 years, I was with Jeff and some great coaches there. Ted Hotelling is the head coach at New Haven. David Boyden is an assistant at UNCG. Dale Wellman won a national championship with Nebraska Wesleyan. So he worked there as well. Just some really good guys.
Was the decision to go from high school to college, what were some of the factors that you considered when you thought about making that leap? Because obviously as a high school teacher and coach, you're making at least some money. And now yeah. You're going to go and say, hey, I'm going to go and be a GA. And so you're kind of taking a slight step back when it comes to your personal income there. But what was your thought process in terms of that and kind of moving your life ahead? Or was it just, hey, I got to take this leap now, or maybe it never happens?
Well, it's funny, Mike. I mean, everyone talks about when they go back, how little they were making, but I was making $21,000. I remember it was a $1,500 stipend. So I was up to $22,500. So it wasn't that much of a hit. The West Virginia stipend was $10,000.
Okay. All right. So you weren't doing too bad.
I was not getting slammed. And then classes being paid for too. So I was able to get my master's while I was there in athletic coaching. The mindset was there were even a few parents, you know, it's a private school that, even though I was super qualified and cared like crazy about their kids, parents are a bit crazy at times. And so, you know, some of them didn't like how I was using their son, let's say. And I can remember pretty vividly, you know, just being like, man, here I'm getting, criticized by people that did not play college ball. I mean, I've done that. All I do is study this game. And I came from a unbelievable high school program. I mean, I was pretty far ahead of the game. And I say that humbly, but that got me thinking, man, I mean, if that's how this is, I should at least look into. And, you know, again, like I'm not married, no kids at the time. Like if I'm going to do this thing, why not try it? And if it doesn't work out, come right back to high school.
So the transition, what did you immediately like about college basketball compared to your high school experience?
Whew, I mean, the pressure in a way, you know, the high stakes, you know, working with great players, older guys, maturity, you know, I think for me that 18 to 22 range is certainly better. Although I love the high school level and the impact that you can have at either level. But the maturity, I think, was better for me. And then the experience. I got my PhD working with John Beeline. So we're talking about a Hall of Famer who, you know, teaches you everything in terms of having a language for everything that you do, turnover prevention. I mean, just how he sees the game, the film that we're going to watch daily. I mean, all these things are things that I've internalized and do with our program now in terms of the film and how we take care of the ball and find a secondary defense is going to mess with teams. So just super grateful for that, you know, that year that I got with Coach.
What was the leap like to go from a GA to you're a full-fledged assistant at Eastern Kentucky? What was that like, both in terms of responsibilities, things that you needed to do? Just what was that adjustment? And obviously, again, you're talking about two different levels of Division I between West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky. So just what was that transition like for you going from West Virginia to Eastern Kentucky?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've always been a worker and a grinder and got that from my dad. So I don't have many hobbies outside of like reading and working out. So it's like, you know, I felt prepared, you know, going into each of these. I played with high level players in high school. So I wasn't, it was an easy transition for me working with Big East guys and then even OVC guys. And I'm, you know, relationship guy. So building relationships with players is the part that I really enjoy. And then the recruiting. So, you know, it was really more, I loved our staff and just, you know, I got a growth mindset. So I just went in, let me learn everything. Let me be a sponge, do whatever coach wants me to do, be all in for my group. And it was a blast, you know, the workouts, you know, taking copious notes and saving those notebooks. And, yeah, I guess that would sum it up, but the high stakes, the pressure, I kind of welcome that stuff too, that, you know, each game and each day matters and you can't have a bad day.
What's one or two things that you would take away from your time as an assistant at Eastern Kentucky that you feel like you still maybe fall back on when you're thinking about trying to help the coaches that are part of your staff as an assistant? Like, hey, here's something that I learned that made me a better assistant that you share as a head coach with your assistants or your staff?
Man, that's a good question, Mike. That's a hard thing to boil down into a couple. Because you're just so, like you're just in it. It's like, you know, all day, all year, you internalize a lot of things. Looking back, I mean, relationships is everything. I try to make sure guys understand, like the guys that, I'm still close with many of those players and definitely close with the guys on that staff. And so, you know, just having that care for one another, is something that I want to take with me wherever we are. And I want our players to also understand how important the impact of relationships are life. I once read a quality life or the quality of your life is determined by the quality of your relationships. And so I'd say getting the right people on the bus is one of the biggest things. And Noobs was so organized, with how he thought through the game and everything else that came with it. So just learned a lot about being forward thinking and having a vision and a plan for how you wanted to play and how you wanted to win.
As you think about that relationship piece, and let's apply it to what you've been able to do at Randolph-Macon, how do you go about through the recruiting process making sure that you have the right guys? What are some of those intangible things that, A, you look for when you're going to watch a player, and then how do you identify whether or not that kid has the sort of intangibles? What kind of questions are you asking them? What are you looking for from them? Again, obviously they have to have a skill set that's going to enable them to play at your level, but what do you look for from an intangible standpoint to know that they're going to fit in with your program?
Yeah. And we've really tried to narrow this down. I wish there was one or two questions. We've tried to make it a system of recruiting. I would say you've got to get them to be open and honest, tell the truth, be vulnerable. That can be hard in itself to get a guy to open up. There's a lot of things that you want to get them on your campus. You want to spend that time with them. You want them spending time with your guys. I mean, we trust our guys a ton, and I think that's an important piece. Guys, tell us what you think. You know, guys can put on a show sometimes, like a job interview. Everyone knows how to ace the job interview. I've learned that. I think kids come in the recruiting process, they tell you everything you want to hear, how hard they're going to work, that they're just looking for the right fit, which isn't always the case. You know, they're just waiting for their level, or they're waiting for an offer. I don't know. Self-awareness is a superpower, Mike. We say that a lot in our program. We say truth over harmony. So I want to give some kids some truth in the recruiting process. I want to tell them the things that I see, like, hey, we wouldn't accept this here. And I want to see how they respond to it. But truth over harmony is a big one. And the self-awareness, you know, because do they think they're better than they are? That's going to be a problem. Now, it can be a good thing too. I want confidence. All right. We're not trying to shoot a guy down, but his relationship to feedback is really important. I think that's what I'm saying is, you know, your self-awareness is, well, coach, what do you see? You know, how engaged are they? Will they be proactive about the feedback loop? You know, I mean, it's not rocket science. What we want, really good players. And I think so you have that baseline of athleticism. Do they have a strength that will carry over? And can they be the best at it on our team? So, you know, when you hire for a business, you want to hire for strength. We try to apply that in recruiting. Why would we hire Mike for our team? Well, this guy shoots the heck out of it. Okay. He shoots it better than anybody we have. Okay. Probably going to get on the floor for us. So we look for the strengths. You know, we look for a reason that's going to get them on the floor. I want to be able to, like, they've got to have a role. They've got to have something that they can do. Like, we took a guy that's not a great shooter, but he's a great rebounder and he's a good versatile defender. And that guy started for us first at the three, then moved him to the four because he has a strength that's a high enough level to help us win a championship.
Yeah, being able to find a kid that has the right role, good. They can have something that they can bring to the table that you know that you can count on that skill day in, day out. That makes a huge, huge difference. I thought it was interesting that you just said there, was talking about how players react to feedback. And probably 2-3 months ago, we had Mark Hendrickson on the podcast. And Mark is one of, I think, 12 people to ever play Major League Baseball and in the NBA. And Mark was talking about what it means to be a pro athlete. And he said, in his mind, what sets a pro athlete apart from somebody who's not a pro is their ability to very, very quickly self-assess, self-correct mistakes. So they're never looking to externalize blame for what happened. They're always looking to internalize the situation and say, what could I have done better, or what was wrong about my technique? And he said that pro athletes that he's been around that are super successful, they're able to make that correction. And then they're also always seeking feedback from coaching staff, players, teammates. Hey, what can I do better? How can I do this and get better at it? And I think that that's an underrated skill for any athlete, is the ability to take coaching and internalize it in such a way that you recognize that this coach is trying to make me a better player. Whereas too often, I think, especially when you go down to younger levels, how do kids tend to look at that? They tend to look at it as criticism and they get defensive and, well, I didn't do that. Or, I look at what I'm doing here. And I think that ability to take feedback to me is critical. I think that's a great point that you bring up in terms of how you end up maximizing a kid's ability. If they're willing to take coaching, man, you can get so much more out of them.
Well, none of us ever got good by ourselves. And that's the thing. And it's like, we're here to partner. I mean, we love partnerships with our guys to help get them to the best version of themselves. And if they're going to be resistant to that, then we can't even do our job. And so trust is going to be big. And I think you're building that in the recruiting process the whole time. And it's like little things, you know, you ask them, tell me about your career. Tell me about your high school career. Go all the way back to freshman year. You know, tell me about your relationship with your coach. You know, I mean, that uncovers a lot. Guys will talk about their high school coach, and, you know, the way that some of those guys answer that question, it's like, you know, that guy's not going to fit here. And it helps us because we just move on.
When you're recruiting, how do you balance what you see from a player with their high school team versus what you see when they're with their AAU team? How do you balance that out? Is there one particular thing you're looking for in one situation and not the other? Just how do you balance that?
I think multiple evaluations can be good. What I've learned is you really have to be careful. We've got a great player for us now, starter, all league guy, that I don't know that he was on an AAU team that his strength showed. And so thankfully I didn't see him with his AAU team, because if I saw him with his AAU team, I don't think he would have stood out to me. And we saw him with his high school team, And so that's, I mean, and I saw him, I went to see a different kid. He was a sophomore. I was like, man, that kid's going to be a college player. And then he looked good with that high school junior year. Then I saw him at AAU that junior year. And I'm like, is this the same kid? I wasn't sure. Like, are we making a mistake? Now he played with our guys and the guys loved how he drove and kicked. And so, okay, all right, let's go. Josh, come on. And so it's like, Mike, I, you know, sometimes, and I've been doing this for a while, like I don't, you have to be careful. Like you can see somebody play, like, you know, we've got Pittsburgh and Hoop Group next weekend. Everybody's got their different events, right? For these live periods, the D3s can go to, but you can almost, you know, you have to be careful. You want to do a thin slice, see a kid, you know, get a feel, but you can also make mistakes. One of my mentors, Nathan Davis, who's head coach at Bucknell, would say, Josh, I've made 100 mistakes in recruiting and I'm going to make 100 more tomorrow. And that's recruiting, man. You're going to make mistakes. It's trying not to make the same ones and trying not to make them over and over again or too many of them.
Yeah. Well, you and I are going to have to connect in person because I'm going to be out in Pittsburgh next weekend with my son. So
nice.
This will be our first time. He's a sophomore. This will be our first time really getting out. And we've played pretty much locally up to this point. And we're going to take his team that I'm just a parent on the team. I'm just I'm along for the ride, but I'm going to be out there. So we'll have to make sure we connect.
What team name is it?
We are Mac Basketball 2024. Izzy is our team.
Mac Basketball. Okay.
Yeah. So nice. we got a nice group. It's a group that has, I think, a lot of kids that are going to have some ability to play at the D3 level for sure. And it's a fun group to be around. So we're curious to see. They've played two tournaments locally, played really well. You know, we're curious to see when they get out and travel and go at a little bit higher level, what it looks like. But it's been fun for my son because he's just caught the bug in the last probably year and a half, and the light bulbs come on for him. And so it's kind of fun to see him playing playing with some better kids. And it's been a good experience for him. So I'm looking forward to that for sure.
I bet. Yeah. Awesome.
All right. So after you leave Eastern Kentucky, then you go and you're at Randolph-Macon, going back to the Division III level, going back to your roots as a player. What's that transition like? What do you think about in terms of, obviously, at a Division I level, you have a bigger budget, you got a bigger staff. Now you're at the Division III level. What was that transition like for you? Obviously, you were already familiar with the level of play and sort of how things went, but not on the coaching side of it. So what do you remember about that?
Not on the coach's side. And I would say the program I played in didn't have maybe the same infrastructure, systems, commitment of the players that was in place Randolph-Macon, you know, with the coaches that have come before. Mike Rose was before Nathan. I worked for Nathan Davis. It was really good for me because I wanted to see how do you run a high level Division III program? And I got to see it that year. You know, they had just been to the Final Four the year before. They returned just about everybody from that team. And so I think we went 25-5 the year that I was an assistant, and it was a bunch of, you know, it was a high level team and group that was really well coached by Nathan Davis. So I was thankful for my time in Eastern Kentucky because I thought in recruiting, it helped me hit the ground running, working at a place where you did have to beat the bushes and recruit a wider geographical area. I was able to just kind of, you know, start calling Charlotte and let's recruit Charlotte. We ended up getting two kids out of Charlotte. You know, I already knew guys in Maryland, but we hit the ground in Maryland. We recruited Virginia. You recruit Pennsylvania. You recruit, and there's not many guys in Delaware, but Jersey is another state. So you've got to, you know, maybe basically draw about a 4 to 6 hour radius and try to make sure you know every kid in Virginia. So I would say, and I'm the only assistant at the time. We had another volunteer that would show up for practice, but it's I'm responsible for the scouts, responsible for the recruiting. It was a grind. You know, you go from a staff of six to a staff of two, and it makes you prioritize. You're still, you know, working to develop and spend time with the players. But it was a heck of a transition, but it was a great one too, because Nathan empowered me. He gave me a lot of responsibility. I learned a lot that year based on how he, you know, allowed me to grow.
Did you feel like you made that move with the idea that being a Division III head coach was something that was going to be in your future based on the fact that that was the level that you played at? Was there a part of you that was wanting to get back to that level with the idea that, hey, as I progress down my career and I start looking at what's going to be a good fit for me, rather than continuing to sort of chase the Division One assistant role that maybe going back and going Division Three, that might have been a path for you to get to a head coaching position and be at the Division Three level. Is that kind of your thought process?
That was. I mean, if you had asked me, and someone did, year three, Eastern Kentucky, would you want to go coach Division Three, go back to Salisbury? I was like, no. You know, I was still in it and still learning and growing. And year five, it wasn't that I wasn't doing those things, but it's like, all right, would a 6-year here versus 1 year in this program help better prepare me for being a head coach? I mean, that's what I wanted to be. So I knew I could toil Division One for another 25 years to maybe get a terrible job. Or one that's really hard to win. And so, you know, I started looking at that. And also, I couldn't get involved with the Division III jobs being a Division I assistant. You know, a lot of times they want to get one of their own in a way. And so I couldn't even get involved for an interview in the league that I played in. And that got my wheels turning basically in year four and then in year five. And also being the oldest of nine, felt like I was missing out on all my siblings growing up being in Kentucky. And you can't choose your job certainly in coaching a lot of times, or you can't just pick it in Division One for sure. So, you know, when Randolph Macon opened, it was like an opportunity to get back to the East Coast and get back home and also put myself in a position where I could really learn. And then if an opportunity popped up, because here's the thing that Nathan said, he said, I want a 2-year commitment. The only exception would be if your alma mater opens up. And then sure enough, I was only with them for a year because Salisbury opened and I went through that process. It's the only job that I interviewed for and ended up getting it and being there for 4 years before coming back to Macon.
What did that interview process look like for you? What do you remember about it?
Oh, man, you would ask me that. It was special because many of the coaches that were there when I was a player were still there. So, you know, I was giving some hugs. First handshakes, even the custodian, man, Big Mike, who was my guy, who would play with us every once in a while, you know, just sharing a big hug with that guy. He's like, oh, my gosh, you might be the coach. It was a cool, cool moment seeing him again. But special place in my heart, you know, to have the chance to go back at the school that I played. And it was a great 4 years. And I met my wife there, Morgan. She was working in student activities. And, you know, that's the other thing. You know, Division One, man, we were grinding and I had blinders on and it was all about career. And so, you know, it was nice to be able to, because I did want to have a family and be a husband and a dad at some point. So, you know, maybe it offered the opportunity for that too.
When you first got that job, did you feel like that was the destination because that was your alma mater?
I felt like I could have retired there, Mike, if, you know, if I could have helped, if I could have kept the standard. Then I felt like that would have been a great, it was a dream to go back and coach at my alma mater, and be alongside some of those coaches and players that were there. It's a great spot.
When the opportunity comes at Randolph-Macon, what does that look like? What's the discussion that you have with your wife? What does that look like in terms of, hey, again, this is my alma mater. This is a place that we feel like, man, we could probably spend our life here. But what made Randolph-Macon the right opportunity? Obviously, you had already been there, so you'd kind of been behind the curtain and knew what the program was all about, what the potential was. But just talk a little bit about what you saw in Randolph-Macon that made you want to make that jump.
Yeah, I mean, you alluded to it. I had been there. Rich tradition. I mean, basketball is super important. Athletics in general. And not that it isn't in Salisbury, but also the geography of it. Being able to raise the family in Richmond. And my wife, who had basically gone to undergrad at Salisbury and then got her master's. And then I'm like, if she never gets to try any other job, man, I hope that's going to be okay 10 years, 15 years from now, because I'm going to be locked in here. If I want to keep coaching. And so, you know, I think it provided maybe because she works in higher ed still, you know, she has a job at Randolph-Macon working in student academic support. And so, you know, just felt like there would be more opportunities. There's only so many places. There's only one college on the Eastern Shore there and only so many opportunities. So it was a family decision. We were expecting our first at the time. And I think Randolph-Macon, Jeff Burns did a good job of saying, you know, you're our guy. We want you here. And this is why we think you can be successful.
When you get there, obviously there's a tradition of success already in place. And so clearly there's a difference between taking over a program where you got to rebuild everything. you're coming into a place that has had previous success, that you know that the things that you need are in place. But when you first got the job, what was your first priority or two that you looked at and said, if we're going to get this program, the vision that I have for it, what are some things that we need to do right out of the gate to get it going in the direction that you wanted to get it going?
Well, I know the first thing, well, I'll say working for Nathan, I thought he's one of the best I've ever been around. And I said, man, I wouldn't want to follow this guy. And then forgot my own advice. It was a tough transition, Mike. I would say that was the toughest one of all. And it's because my last year at Salisbury, because I took over a program that has basically been, you know, 500, maybe if you look at the record over the maybe the history of that program. And we had some good years. My year two and year four, 21 wins. It was like the fifth most in school history at the time. So maybe the fifth and sixth best records in two of my 4 years there. And so I felt like I was, you know, figuring some things out, until I wasn't, because it's completely different set of, it's completely different people. 17 guys I took over that I did not recruit one of them. I didn't have relationships built up. You can't, you know, fast forward that stuff. The trust hadn't been built. And yet they went 28-3 the year before I got there. Then they graduated seven seniors. And so you got this young group that thinks it's their turn, but they're nowhere near ready and don't meet the standard. I remember driving to see all the incoming freshmen and building those relationships. And those guys were the backbone of the program and helped plant the seeds for what was to come, because they were better, the freshman class, better than the sophomore class. So the sophomore class started kind of, you know, dropping out of hoops, which can happen, and would have been fine if Nathan was still the coach. I mean, he would have coached the heck out of that team to 20 wins. I did not do a good job in that transition. And so, you know, I've owned that. And I tell my AD there's hundreds of things I would do different if I could do it over again. I say it all falls on me. Or we went 13-14, I believe, that year. And we should have been better. We underachieved. And it's because I didn't know what I didn't know. And probably would have been better off if it was my first job, because you're taking some things that have worked or didn't work. But it was not, we got through it, is what I'll say. We got through it, Mike. And my first 3 years at Randolph-Macon, we did not win an ODAC playoff game. And that was tough, man. At a place where they expect to win and win a national championship, you know, seven most wins in Division III, you're expected to win. And to not even win an ODAC. And by the way, we're the 2 seed and the 1 seed two of those 3 years. Like, it's not like we didn't have bad, it's not like we had bad regular seasons. But it created something in us. Adversity is a requirement for growth. It created something in us, the power of every possession, you know, having an attitude, a mistake response. So much good came out of that. And I think, you know, the growth happens in the extreme. We had an extreme low to help build and get to a higher place.
In order to do that, I've heard you say the word relationships a bunch of times. And you think about, if you're going to get where you want to go, you got to build those relationships with players so you have the trust that you talked about. What are some things that you've done over your time there to build relationships with your players? How do you go about doing that on a day-to-day basis? Is it through informal conversation? Are there formal things that you make sure you do with your guys? Just how do you go about building those relationships? What does that look like?
I think the biggest thing is everybody wants to know coach hears me, coach sees me uniquely. I think that's huge. And so we're going to do all of the above, informal, formal, all kinds of systems for meetings. I don't want to overdo it. You know, we're going to do a postseason. I want to hear from them. I want to hear what they have to say, especially when it doesn't match up. I mean, I love to start certain meetings. Do you want the truth or you want harmony? We say truth over harmony all the time. Trust doesn't happen without truth, and truth doesn't happen without trust. And so, you know, you got to build that. They say love is spelled T-I-M-E. And so spending time with them, which we don't get to be on the court with the guys. So how can you build some sweat equity, or at least until the season hits? You know, I'm fortunate, 42, healthy, knock on wood, but I still get out there in season and we do all-star games and I play with the guys, and it's a great growth for me. I get to really learn about them. This is like the young guys or the lower minute guys. Teaches me a lot about what they need. I don't know what I'm going to do when I can't play anymore, because it just gives me great feedback and helps. And then it's like, when I can go get a layup on you or make a shot against you, you're a little more like, how is this old guy still getting buckets? Okay, I better pay attention to what he's saying a little bit more.
That's good stuff. I love that. Yeah, you hold on to your playing career for as long as you can. Mine ended, I think, at 42, 43. I was playing in a tournament with some of my college teammates and tore my ACL in the middle of it. I didn't even realize that. I mean, I felt like it was something weird happened with my knee. It felt like my one part of my leg went one way and one went the other. And the tournament had just started. And I'm like, ooh, that felt weird. And we had six guys. And so I went out in the hallway after the game and I'm jogging, I'm cutting on. I'm like, ah, I think I can play. And I went back and played like eight more minutes of the next game and got that same feeling again, came home and swelled up. And eventually I went to the doctor and they're like, yeah, you tore it. So that was the end of my playing career. Cause I just couldn't play enough. You know, I felt like if I could play 3 or 4 days a week, I'd probably be okay. But once I got to 42, 43 playing once every 3 weeks or once a month, it just wasn't cutting it anymore, unfortunately. But yeah, hold on to your ability to play for as long as you can, Josh.
I'm hoping it doesn't end in an ACL tear.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're either right, the old man basketball injuries, or you're going to the ACL tear or Achilles. Those are the two you see guys go down with all the time if you're still playing at a certain age. Some guys avoid it. And I'd never had an injury ever as a player. I never had a rolled ankle. I never hurt a knee, nothing. So I was super fortunate. And, you know, and then, you know, it all ends with the torn ACL. Yeah. So that's the way it goes. How did you go about as a head coach? Obviously you worked for some great guys and had the opportunity to play for some really good coaches. When you started thinking about how you wanted your teams to play, what you wanted them to look like out on the basketball floor, both from an offensive and defensive standpoint, when do you feel like in your career you had a handle on sort of the way you wanted to play? And obviously the game's evolving. You're constantly learning and adjusting and doing things differently, but clearly there's a style of play that you have that you want to be able to institute with your team. So when do you feel like you had a pretty good handle on, hey, this is what I'm about as a coach?
Man, I almost want to say it's still evolving.
Right. I'm sure it is.
But I will say we're not going to beat ourselves. You know, that's a Beeline and a Belichick thing. We're going to take care of that ball. You know, transition D as a result is going to be pretty good. We're going to make everything tough defensively. Nothing, no rocket science here. We were all man-to-man. I'm a big man-to-man guy. But then, you know, we tinkered with the 1-3-1. Wasn't great with our personnel. I see Dale Wellman, good buddy of mine. I worked with him at Eastern Kentucky. Win a national championship with a 3-2 zone, and he and I talk about it. And so we put it in, but we don't work on it a ton. But that thing was needed for this year's team and personnel, and that evolved and really got better as we worked on it more this year. So, you know, we'll go into next year and we'll have both man and the 3-2, and we'll see, you know, does it work for this group and this personnel? You know, I know 1 year we were good, but played 99% man. And then this year we were pretty good and played 70% man, 30% zone. So offensively, man, I messed up again that first year because I felt a little more better with maybe 4-out, 5-out, open spacing, pro style, stat concepts. Nathan was such a good motion coach, and I felt like they won with it. So who am I to come in here with the new approach that really is based on player strengths? And there wasn't a ton of separation. Like we had one all league guy, and then like 2 through 15, like on any given day, it was really hard to kind of coach that group in that way. So what we have now is, you know, we're going to play the guy's strengths, hunt the paint, play inside out, play unselfish basketball. You know, we're going to make some calls, but I love when those guys can play freely within the structure, make those reads that they need to make. And it takes time. I mean, I'm always like in the beginning, you can ask my assistant, I'm like, why don't we have a system? Like, I mean, this started this year, like I'm watching ball screen motion. I'm watching Roanoke and they're crisp and they're firing. And I'm like, why aren't we running a system? But by the end of the year, I think our players appreciate, you know, almost like a Jazz where you have creativity every possession. And we don't exactly know what it's going to look like. but guys can really play to strengths. They understand each other. They get to read the defense. And it's a fun way to play. But the thing is, you better not turn it over while we're figuring it out.
How does that play into your practice design? So when you're putting together your practice plans and you're thinking about how you're trying to develop, guys' IQ, you're trying to get them to learn how to play the game. You're not just having them run through. Again, it's the old thing. You're teaching them how to play. You're not teaching them plays. But yeah, we all know that's a little messier. And like you just said, it doesn't always look pretty, especially at the beginning when guys are trying to figure it out. So when you're putting together your practices, let's just say in the preseason where you're trying to kind of teach your style of play to guys that are new to the program and you're relying on your upperclassmen to put that in. Just what does practice design look like for you?
I mean, competition is going to be a huge piece of it. So we're going to keep score. And early on, we're going to, you know, run for that. We call them winners and learners. Learners are going to run. I think that's how you build the effort. I think you can throw everything else out the window if you're not getting great effort. And I've made that mistake before too. You know, X and O schemes. Okay, I know how to do this, and we know how to, switch a ball screen and then get the triple switch and all that stuff. None of that stuff matters if you're not playing with great effort all the time with consistency. So now it's more, let's say, constraints with some of our drills. We like to call them drills to create self-awareness, so that guys can really learn what they do better, what their strength is, and who they're playing with. I mean, if you're a big-time shooter and I'm not finding you, then that's a problem. If you're a big-time shooter but you can't get ignition, then, you know, I'm going to challenge you like, Mike, why are you putting the ball on the floor? You're killing the offense every time you do it. And where are you going? You're not getting anywhere. Let Buzz go create the ignition, and he's going to put it on a platter. He's going to get you 1,000 points just by you getting to space and you learning how to move and be a cutter. So those drills help guys really become more aware, and we'll dial in on that, you know, of really being a stud with your strengths.
What do you track and chart during practice? Anything?
You have a manager tracking a bunch, and almost like value points. So at the end of the day, you know, Mike's got plus 30 and Josh has plus 20. And we've got kind of a system there. Nothing crazy. Field goals made, attempted, rebound, steals, deflections. I will say the big three stats that we really pay attention to in games are going to be the field goal differential, the turnover differential, and the rebound differential. I mean, it's nothing, no rocket science, nothing different than what a lot of people are tracking. We also write down charges that we take, and we write down how many stops in a row. You know, we call them bricks. People have different names for it, but we want to get 7 of those in a game.
Yeah, I think if you have things that, right, your players understand that, hey, this is what we're looking for. And it sounds like from what you're talking about, that the ability to value the ball and not turn it over. And, you know, again, if you're going to give your players the freedom to play loose, like you said, they have to be able to play free and loose, but then there's some expectations, right? It's with great, freedom comes great responsibility. And yeah, so if you're going to be given the opportunity to go and play without a lot of constraints, then you have to be able to be trusted. And it goes through that whole thing and being able to build it out with your players so that you can play that style of play. And obviously it's something that's, right, it's attractive to players. Players don't necessarily enjoy going through, hey, we're going to run this continuity offense where I got to keep doing the same thing over and over again. I think players, especially in today's game, they want to play the way that you're talking about. But at the same time, they got to be able to play and take care of the ball and understand what good shots are. And it's all about building the player's IQ through what you do day in and day out.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll watch a ton of film too. So I think a big part of our team and awareness is built through those 15 minutes of clips before practice. And then you work to apply it, you know, go from theory to practice when you hit the floor.
How do you balance out when you're sharing film with players? How do you balance out showing them things that they did correctly versus things that they did incorrectly? What's the balance there?
We try to criticize in private and praise in public as much as you can, pulling guys aside for those individual clips. But we're going to show the defensive crimes a lot of times after games. And even in practice, we'll say, hey, stop it at the scene of the crime. You know, so we'll go back to where Mike beat Josh and, all right, Josh, fix it this time. And then we're going to play from there again. So yeah, we you got to point that stuff out again. The truth over harmony. Hey, you guys want the harmony or you want the truth? We weren't very good defensively. Here's a few clips that we have to be better at that we're going to address in practice. And until we get it right, we're going to keep drilling this stuff, which isn't going to be the most fun. But once we get it right, then we can move on to more fun things. Kind of, you know, that might be one of the themes.
How much film are you watching during the season?
During the season, I'm grinding a lot of film. I would say, you know, a couple hours, couple 3 hours, depending on the day and then maybe the family responsibilities. But I'm going to watch probably at least three games of our opponent, hopefully more. And then I'll watch in practice of us every single day. So and maybe February, getting away from it a little bit. But that's if we're humming and I feel really good about how we're our approach.
Talking about family, when you started, you mentioned a couple of times, hey, I'm single. I got all this time. I can do all those things. And then obviously, you know, once you have a family, things change. And you have responsibilities, not just with your players and your basketball team, but you have responsibilities at home. So I'm always curious just to talk with coaches about how they, whether it's incorporating their family into their program, how you just think about the balance and the rhythm of your year, obviously as a Division III head coach, the rules in Division III and the amount of contact that you can have with your players in the off season affords you more of an opportunity to take a deep breath and spend more time with your family in the off season than you would be if you were on the 52 week a year plan at the Division I level, which we've talked to a bunch of coaches about that, whether that's a positive or negative. But just talk a little bit about balancing out your family responsibilities with your basketball responsibilities.
Yeah, I would say more rhythm than balance. Like the season has a way different rhythm than the off season. My wife is a stud, and you know, I wish she was here so she could hear me bragging on her.
She'll be able to hear it. She'll be. You can force her to listen to this at some point.
She's tremendous with three boys and really helps. And then my mother-in-law even moved in the neighborhood. So she's been awesome this year. And we have a 6, a 2, and a 5-month-old. You know, as you know, as a dad, your time is no longer your own, especially when they're young. It's like Absolutely. You're just meeting their needs. But it's been awesome. Like our kids love basketball right now. They love going to games. I love having them be around practice and, it's been a joy, like even some of the playoff games and those guys cutting down a net or being in the hotel shoot around. Honestly, our guys love when they're around because they know coach really can't lose it on us today. All right. Mason's in the back of the film room.
Yeah.
We're going to be okay in this film session.
Nice. That's good stuff.
There was one that I did lose it and forgot that Mason was back there. And I'm not a big cursor, but I mean, I was going at some guys. And I just remember looking back there and his eyes were like this big. And I was like, oh, man. Like,
whoa, I never saw this side of dad before. Look what I got to look forward to.
He never said one word about it, man. So that was pretty cool.
That's funny. That's good stuff. That is good stuff. All right. Let's dive into this season a little bit and talk about, let's go back to the beginning preseason. Last year gets cut short because of COVID. You guys were probably on track to at least compete for a national championship last year with the team that you had. So coming into this year, what was the mindset? Where were you at with your comfort level with the team, where they were? Just go back to the preseason, what your expectations were, what you thought they were capable of.
Preseason, I mean, shoot, you know, people thought highly of us. We didn't think that highly of ourselves. I can tell you, like, we finished the year, go back a year before the COVID year, 28-2, just like Elmhurst. You talked to John Baines, that team that we were Sweet 16. We had a home game to go to the Elite Eight and the season was done. That team was good. That team was humming. And then here we are 12-0 COVID. I don't know how good we are. We knew we, you know, solid because a lot of those guys were back and, you know, we certainly got our top four scorers back and all that. So, but we did the same thing. We returned our top four scores. We had a veteran group. We knew that, to me, the thing that was going to beat us could be ourselves. And to me, if we weren't hungry, if we started feeling ourselves, then that was going to be a detriment to our growth too. So we just took a growth mindset into every game. We took a chip on our shoulder into every practice, I would say, you know, just kind of relentless. I'm probably relentless about the standard and about, our guys were unbelievable. I mean, starting with Buzz Anthony, our point guard, I could tell you one quick story. So he's had a pro mindset since his freshman year. A lot of guys want to be a pro. Then they start working like a pro as a senior. Okay. This guy came in as a freshman and he was a pro. He's got his goals up. He's got his structure. His workouts are specific. So he would do these Kobe workouts, 6 weeks of the preseason. He gets in there and basically he gets three workouts in between two team workouts that we do. We'd lift Friday. Then he'd come back and go at 9 p.m., 2 a.m., 8 a.m., and then we'd play at 9 a.m. All right. Hopefully I explained that well. But first couple of years, he's doing it on his own. Maybe a guy comes in at night. Maybe a guy comes in the morning. But this particular preseason, you had 11 guys in there. And again, no coaches in the gym. This is not anything that I put on them. He called it the Kurt X workouts in honor of a former player. And 11 guys, 6 weeks, three workouts, 2 a.m. in the gym, working on their own stuff. Pretty cool. So, you know, to me, when we you also have talent and we're connected, and I don't know how many other people are working like that. We felt like we, you know, it's when you start playing those games and games are tight, I think you earn a level of confidence and preparation that says, you know, we're not giving into this thing and we've done more than maybe this other team.
Was there a moment during the season early on, midway through, where you felt like, man, this light has really come on for these guys? And if things go our way, we're going to have a shot at winning this whole thing. Was there a moment, or was it more just sort of a culmination of kind of all the work that that guys had put in that you just described?
Yeah, I don't think there was a moment. I mean, I basically go into every game like, man, if we can come out on top of this game, like we might have a chance to be good this year. I mean, I was probably saying that. My wife is always laughing at me. She's because I'm like, if we could just get this one.
There's a coach's mindset for you right there, Josh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Even with Elmhurst, I wasn't relaxing until about 1 minute to go, which, you know, looking back is kind of crazy. But that's just how, I don't know, that's how we approached it. Is basically coach the heck out of every possession and play to the standard. And if guys weren't doing that 38 minutes in, I mean, there's a lot of halves where I would not look at the scoreboard because I just wanted to be locked in on the process and how we were playing and let that score take care of itself.
All right. So as you get through and you get through your regular season and you get to the tournament, what's the mindset? What's the conversation like when you sit down in the locker room or a team meeting with your guys heading into the tournament? Is there things that you've learned through your career that you share with your guys from a mentality standpoint, from a preparation standpoint? How do you approach that when you're going into the tournament? Because obviously now you're in a one and done situation. It's a little bit different than the regular season. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, our approach was, and I think it can be different for every team, but this year's team was fearless was the word. And if you want to, you know, take another phrase, trust your training. Like, we're not going to panic. And if we go down, it's because the other team played a hell of a game. But just no fear. You know, everybody talked about the pressure. Like, we felt zero pressure. I felt zero pressure. And maybe it's because, you know, our guys were so good and connected and we were a connected group. So maybe that helped. Maybe I'll feel some pressure next year. but we talked about, yeah, fearless mindset is not the absence of fear, but it's fearing less and just going for it. Like, you know, we're not gonna tiptoe around it, man. We're gonna go. And I think, you know, in the scores and our approach reflected a group that was not fearful of a result, not fearful of a loss. So that's one thing I was proud of the guys for.
What does that look like during practice? So when you're talking about that, hey, we're gonna be fearless, how do you get them to understand what that looks like? And obviously they've had a series of games over the course of the season where you can point and look to, and I'm sure that was something you talked about throughout the season, but just as you're in the practice, you're preparing for your next opponent. And, you know, there are days, right, where you have, you know, you're playing on Friday and then you're coming back and playing on Saturday where you don't have much prep time to prepare for that next opponent. So what's the mindset there in terms of making sure that they keep that fearless mentality?
We talked about, we are empowering you. I remember just watching film and saying, you know, Hey, Will, you are empowered to go after that ball, make this play. Are you worried about getting beat? Are you worried that your guy was going to get open for a shot? No, you're empowered. This guy's turning his back. Go attack that ball. So, I mean, that would be the word that we probably used a ton is and try to show them what fearlessness looks like, playing fearless, playing confidently. Hey, man, you're a killer. Let this shot fly. And guys just really, you know, they were connected to their strengths, I would say, self-aware, knew who should be getting most of the shots, but also that if they were open and the ball found them, they were letting that thing fly. Nobody was really afraid of the moment. And we coached it like, you know, we coached the first game of the season, whether we're up by 30, really the same that we would a national championship game, so that when you get in those moments, nothing feels different.
When the buzzer goes off and you win the championship, what's the feeling that you get? Describe it. Is it, you know, sometimes you hear guys say it's a relief that, you know, you kind of had this season where, hey, we finally got it done. I'm relieved. Was it happiness? Was it joy for your guys? Just what was going through your mind when the buzzer goes off and you know that the thing that you worked hard for this entire season that was kind of on your mind that you got there, what did it feel like?
Number one, just felt for John Baines and his crew because I thought it was a hell of a team. And I don't think the final score reflected how good they were. They were better than that final score. So kind of my heart went out to them because I feel like that could have been us. You know, I want to shake those guys' hands, try and remind them how great a season they had. That was number one. Then seeing the joy. Actually, I saw my players celebrating, and if I could do it over again, I'd get them to maybe shake hands first and then celebrate.
That's hard though, man. That's a hard position to be in as a coach, isn't it? Like I see that a lot of times in the high school games and stuff, and teams win and they're celebrating and the other team just kind of has to stand there and soak it all in. That's tough for kids and obviously as coaches too. That's tough to stand there.
I don't think John, their head coach, felt disrespected by it or any of their players did, and we eventually got over there. But I remember seeing the joy, man, the hugs. You know, we still have some great pictures of those guys hugging each other on the bench. That's what I'm going to take away is, that confetti comes down. It's a pretty cool thing. Knowing that there wasn't another game to prepare for, that's the first time I've really felt that, you know, because 28-2 and it's like, all right, well, we got to go win this thing that everyone says we can, are capable of winning. And then COVID year. And it's like, all right, well, we're going to next year trying to win this thing. So it was, joy was the word, Mike. I've probably a younger version of me wouldn't have been able to enjoy it as much. I think COVID has helped me, you know, even just control the controllables, man. Be grateful for what you have. And I was certainly grateful for this group, for the opportunity to kind of punch through, you know, for so many guys and their families. It was just really a special thing. And they do a good job there in Fort Wayne too, making it a big deal, you know, CBS, all that went into it. It just felt like a really cool thing. Didn't feel any different than probably Kansas felt.
Exactly. Right. I mean, again, it's you're going through the same process and the result that you get at the end and the amount of work that you put in to be able to do it. And then obviously, as you said, that with the way that the previous two seasons had ended, it gave you closure on what's normally would be one season. Really, it was almost closure on three full seasons, which is a long time for that delayed gratification to be able to get there. And so now you look at it and you say, okay, I think one of the things that I've always found to be interesting in our conversations here on the pod is people always talk about, well, you know, we've built this thing and then how do we sustain it? And, you know, obviously your goal is going to be to win a national championship every year. It's something that, you know, you're not probably going to be able to do every year. So how do you define success beyond the scoreboard? And when you think about what's coming in the next year, two, 3 years, how do you define sustaining the success that you've been able to build to this point beyond the scoreboard?
Yeah, I mean, the mission, you go back to the mission is to develop young men and help them be successful after, you know, their playing career is over. So, you know, just enjoying that process of development on and off and all that goes into it, the leadership journey, all those things. For us, we kind of talk about we want to play as many games as possible, which means advance, 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 and then find a way to win the last game. And to me, to be at our best when our best is needed and be a buzzsaw at the end of the year, that's what we want to be. So the growth mindset, all of those things, you know, you can have some losses, you can have some bumps along the road. You probably need those. You know, some people brought up our one loss and it's like, man, that we weren't out to have a perfect season. Like that loss helped us. It propelled us. It showed us that we weren't where we needed to be. And I'm grateful for it. I'm glad we didn't have to have 10 of them to get there, but maybe that's what next year will look like. You know, we just don't know. And I am excited. I'm looking forward to the challenge and you know, winning a different way. I saw this, John Shire said this about Duke. But you know, he says Duke is, you know, you find out how to win. And I like to say RMC is certainly, it finds ways to win. And you know, how are we going to do that next year? Excited to see what we do.
All right. We're coming up close to an hour and a half. I think we're approaching the midnight hour here. So I want to wrap it up with one final two-part question. First part, when you look ahead over the next, let's say 3 years, what do you see as being the biggest challenge in front of you? And then number two, when you get out of bed every morning, what's your biggest joy that you get from being the head coach at Randolph-Macon? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Biggest challenge. The first thing I thought of is, you know, the age of my kids in 3 years is going to be 3, 5, and 9.
You're right, man. You're just headed towards being a youth sports parent. We're gonna recycle this in 5 years and see what that conversation looks like for sure.
I'm gonna have to be picking your brain at that point. I think the challenge is continuing to get the right guys on the bus, despite, you know, this, let's say, national championship or. You know, we want guys to be choosing us for the right reasons, to be choosing us for the work, for the competition, for who they can become, but not for the glory, not because, you know, it's cool to tell their friends they're playing for, you know, a top ranked team, we'll say. So I think that's going to be the challenge is guys staying hungry, continuing to bring a chip. Cause that's the way to go through life. I think it's the way to be successful is keep hunting challenges in your life. Meaningful work is going to bring you some fulfillment and some joy. And then what brings me joy, man, is the relationships, you know, just getting closer, challenging guys, but having them love you, or knowing that they're loved and that also you're going to be demanding and bring out their best. I will tell you, maybe in closing, the best compliment I got came after the game, Mike, and two of my seniors, they say, come here, coach, we want to tell you something. And they say, you're our favorite coach. You're our least favorite coach at the same time. And they are like, okay, come on, explain. Well, we know that you love us, but man, you're hard to play for. Man, you point out everything in every film session. It's not everything, but I do point out a lot. But we wouldn't have gotten as good as we did playing anywhere else. And man, that was an awesome for them to have the maturity to be able to say that too in the moment. And maybe that's what winning does too, is allow those guys to say what was on their mind. And, you know, I love that truth, man. Give me that truth over harmony. But isn't that even for parents? You know, you're probably the favorite dad and the least favorite dad. And that's, absolutely, you know, that's life, embracing that. But that's what brings me joy, is trying to get to that point for every player.
That's really cool that they gave you that right after the game, because so often you hear that story 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road, a player comes back to you and says, hey, you really pushed me and got the best out of me. But for them to recognize that in the moment, yeah, I'm sure that was just as special of a feeling to put that on top of the national championship. I mean, I can only imagine the thoughts that were going through your mind as they're saying that to you, and how good that felt to understand that the things that you've done, that you feel like you're doing in the best interest of players. It's not often that it gets recognized right in the moment, because we all know it's tough. You have to be demanding. There's a grind to it. There's a lot of work that goes into it in order to be successful. And players don't always recognize that in the moment. It's more often retrospectively that they can look back and get that realization. So for them to be able to share that with you in the moment, I'm sure it was especially gratifying. Before we get out of here, Josh, I want to give you a chance, share how people can reach out to you, whether you want to share email, social media, just how people can connect with you and your program. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. Josh Merkel, all together, at rmc.edu. That's Merkel. I'll give my cell. I don't have a great social media presence. I barely check Twitter. so that's not a good way to reach me anymore. But my cell would be 443-365-3159. And yeah, I look forward to hearing, you know, anybody that has some feedback or ways for us to be better. And if there's a player that, you know, somebody has an uncle in Virginia or in Richmond, with a player that should be on our radar or slipped through the cracks, you know, could be an all-league stud. I'm definitely excited to hear about him.
Sounds like a plan. Josh, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on and join us. A lot of fun talking basketball with you. Again, congratulations on the national championship. And I'm sure you're going to continue to have success. So to everyone out there, we appreciate you listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.